Tonight I'd like to talk about applying mindfulness to chronic stress. And if stress is something you don't know anything about, just kind of pretend that you had that experience, maybe apply it to something else that you can relate to. But the approach, what I want to do is, first of all, kind of start out and talk about where does stress come from, and talk about what the Buddha said about stress. Talk about how it impacts our body, and then talk about a solution and some practices and what we can do and how that also impacts our bodies. Because stress is experienced in our bodies. So stress is really just a common part of life that we all experience, and its sources are many and varied, and a lot of it just comes from the day-to-day existence of the things that we go through that take a toll on us. And stress-related illnesses are commonplace. We're all affected to some degree or another. So many stressors are external. So this might be the work situation we're in, or neighborhood we're in, or people in our life, perhaps relationship conflict, family issues, financial pressures, traffic, aggressive drivers, worries, concerns about our planet, our country, our community, stuff on TV, debates, sometimes health challenges. So, but a lot of the stress is really internally generated, because the reality is that we don't react to what happens around us. We react to what we think about happens around us. And, you know, the Buddha said that all suffering begins in our mind. So, isn't it true that most stress comes because we want to change a situation? We want things to be different than the way they are? Wanting things we don't have, or not wanting things that we do have? And this is really a form of craving or an aversion. And this is what the Buddha talked about as the second noble truth. First truth is that life contains so much dukkha, so much unsatisfactoriness, so much suffering. And the second noble truth is that the cause of this is craving and aversion. It's caused by wanting things to be different than the way they are. When we don't get what we want, we experience anxiety and stress. Woody Allen said, "Life is full of misery, loneliness, and suffering. And it's all over much too soon." So, there's a talk that the Buddha gave called the, and I'm probably not pronouncing this word right, Anusaya Sutta. A-N-U-S-A-Y-A. Anusaya. Anybody else? Anybody know? Anybody willing to correct me? But we're going to go with Anusaya Sutta. And this term, Anusaya, is usually translated as underlying tendency or latent tendency. Basically, it means to be obsessed with something. And he said that there were seven basic Anusayas, or obsessions, that we experience. And he talked about them in this talk or this sutta. And the first is the obsession of sensual passion, which is the tendency to latch on to things that feel good, whatever it is, comfortable chair, chocolate, nice music. Second is the obsession of resistance, which is the fear of things that we don't have any control over. The third is the obsession of views, views and opinions about how we think the world should be, how we think people should be. Four, the obsession of uncertainty. So this is a lack of faith in things that are good for us in the long term, but don't pay off immediately. Is this going to work out? Five, the obsession of conceit, self-centeredness, the tendency to take everything personally. It's all about me. You know, my four favorite words, I, me, my, and mine. Right? Six, the obsession of passion for becoming, meaning it's like the lust for life or the desire to live forever. You know, we all have this desire, we all have this notion a lot of times that we're just going to be around forever. You know, it's like another Woody Allen quote. I'm sure all of you have heard this. You know, he said he had no aversion to die, to death. He just didn't want to be around when it happened. And then the seventh is the obsession of ignorance. And it's ignorance that causes so much of our stress. We want to blame the world and the people in the world for all our anxiety, our stress, our discomfort, when in fact, it's all created in our mind. As the Buddha said, we shoot ourselves with arrow after arrow after arrow. The first arrow is the pain, but the second and the third and the fourth and however many are the stories we tell ourselves. And we just keep shooting ourselves with all these arrows and we create stories upon stories about what's going on. So these are the seven obsessions. And the Buddha's perspective is that these tendencies that we have are always present. They're kind of latent in there. There's that habit pattern to obsess for things to be different. And when something comes along and we have an experience, we contact it through our sense perceptions. So if I hear a sound and it's a dog barking, well, that's a sense perception. I hear it, and then I perceive what it is. And then I create a story about that dog barking. Did they tie up that dog again? Maybe I should call the animal control people. That dog's bothering me. It's bothering everybody. Why are they doing that? Yada, 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 yada. We have a sense perception, and then there's this tendency to want to change the experience. So most of this that happens is really unconscious. Most of the time, it just happens, and it's conditioned mind, and this is what we do, and it creates a lot of stress. Let's take a look at how stress impacts our body and the brain. I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of this. When our body responds to stress, one thing it does is it releases a lot of hormones. It increases our heart rate and our breathing rates. Our brain gets more oxygen, giving us an edge to respond to a problem. So what happens is initially is it helps us cope with a tough situation. So what I relate to is thinking back about our early existence when we were walking through the jungle, through the forest, and there was a saber-toothed tiger. And all of a sudden you notice it, and what happens? Our body responds. Oxygen flow, increased heartbeat, adrenaline. We start running, our body creates perspiration so we can move our arms. Our body eliminates stuff that's inside us to make us lighter and run faster and so on. So these are the kind of responses that we have for survival. But the problem is that we continue to respond in this way throughout our life, even when the threat is not as real as a saber-toothed tiger. And the truth is whether the threat is real or perceived makes no difference. Our body responds the same way. So what happens in our body is our central nervous system, which is in charge of the fight or flight response, is activated. It tells the rest of the body what to do. This is where our limbic system is, the lizard brain. And it's, you know, fight, flight, freeze, collapse. It's like the central command post. It tells us what to do. And this is what helps us survive. And this is what also keeps us trapped when it's activated, when we don't really need it to be. And when the perceived fear is gone or threat, the central nervous system, the limbic system, should tell us to just go back to normal. The job's done. But the problem is the stress still has the impact on our body. Stress hormones affect our respiratory system, our cardiovascular system. It affects our digestive system. The liver produces extra blood sugar, glucose, to give us a boost of energy. The unused blood sugar is reabsorbed by the body. If we're under constant stress, our bodies may not be able to keep up with this extra surge of glucose. So stress is a leading contributor to type 2 diabetes. Muscular system. Our muscles tense when we're constantly under stress. Our muscles don't get a chance to relax. Backaches, headaches. We might turn to pain medication. It affects our sexuality and reproductive system. It's not unusual to lose a desire for sex when we're under chronic stress. For women, stress can really impact the menstrual cycle. Man's testosterone levels drop off. They lose their interest in sex. It hammers our immune system. Absolutely hammers it. Destroys our, wears it out. People under chronic stress are under major threat to viral illnesses like the flu and the common cold, and our increased risk for other diseases and infections. It takes longer to recover from illnesses. So this is the kind of impact that stress can have us on us physically. This isn't new information for probably most of you or all of you. So what about solutions? So we look for solutions, like the guy that goes to the doctor and he says he's really depressed. He says, life is harsh and cruel. He feels all alone in a threatening world. And the doc says, the treatment's very simple. He said, hey, there's a great clown named Terrafini in town tonight. Go see him. That should pick you up. And the guy looks at the doc, bursts into tears and says, but doctor, I'm Terrafini. So maybe that's not going to work. But we have this tool called mindfulness practice that we can use. And it's been around for about 2,600 years. And it's been practiced by many of us. But it's also gone mainstream. And I think it's useful to talk about this a little bit. About for really over 40 years, mindfulness has really entered into medicine and psychotherapy. Some of you may be familiar with mindfulness-based stress reduction that was created by Jon Kabat-Zinn at Harvard Medical Center. And he created it for people who are having chronic stress. What Jon Kabat-Zinn did was he lifted the practice out of Buddhism. He had been a Zen practitioner, and he secularized it in such a way that he could present it to people who, if he had said, I want you to go meditate, they would have gone, oh, I'm not doing any of that. But he presented it in a way as an MD that was susceptible, you know, was successful in that way. And out of mindfulness-based stress reduction, there have been some other programs that have also developed. One is called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. It was developed by three doctors, Dr. Zindel Siegel, Mark Williams, and John Teasdale. It's psychological therapy designed to aid in preventing the relapse of depression. One of the things that's happened because of these practices being introduced into, legitimate medicine, okay? Is that all these studies have been done. By 2012, 477 papers had been written and published on the effects of this. There are over 1,000 mindfulness-based stress reduction instructors in nearly every state in the United States and in over 30 countries. There's also a program been developed called Mindfulness-Based Relapse Prevention, and it was developed by people who work in the field of addiction recovery. And the primary driver of this was a man by the name of C. Allen Marlett, who has since passed on. And what he basically did is he took mindfulness-based practices and he used them for addiction recovery, helping people be able to recognize the experiences that they were having, the thoughts that were arising, the triggers, the urges, the cravings, and be able to work with them rather than falling prey to their old habit patterns of using. It's been used in treatment centers, prisons, and VA centers, and it's something that Margaret and I use in the work that we do in various treatment and aftercare facilities, and it's very successful. One of the practices that we use is called urge surfing, where people identify a certain urge, a certain sensation they have, and we show them how that they can imagine that that urge is on a surfboard and they just ride it out until it dissipates. This all comes out of mindfulness practice. There's also mindfulness-based childbirth education, which helps empower women to become active participants in the birthing process, rather than just sitting back and saying, I wonder what the doctor's going to tell me to do now. And it really addresses common concerns that women have about the lack of control that they perceive in the process. So this has become very, very effective, all these different kinds of practices. MRI scans have shown that after just 8 weeks of this mindfulness practice that's used in the program that Jon Kabat-Zinn developed, 8 weeks, doing just 30 minutes a day, the brain's fight or flight center, the limbic system, the amygdala, actually tends to shrink. They've learned, and this helps regulate stress and anxiety, and then also the prefrontal cortex in the front of the brain, that helps with impulse control and decision making, gets stronger. The gray matter actually increases. And this is the area that helps regulate the other parts of the brain. They've shown that this actually changes in the brain in just 8 weeks. Right? And all the connections that happen in the brain shift and change. Probably most of you have heard of neuroplasticity. This is what mindfulness practice does. There's a researcher and author by the name of Sarah Lazar, PhD, says, although the practice of meditation is associated with a sense of peacefulness and physical relaxation, practitioners have long claimed that meditation also provides cognitive and psychological benefits that persist throughout the day. So this practice can reverse our stress response. In so many ways, it can lower our heart rate, our breathing slows down, blood pressure normalizes, we use oxygen more efficiently, we sweat less, our adrenal glands produce less cortisol, our mind's clear, we lower the likelihood of heart disease, reduce chronic pain, improve sleep, alleviate gastrointestinal difficulties. It's been used for depression, substance abuse, eating disorders, couples conflicts, anxiety disorders, obsessive compulsive behavior. So why does this work and how does it work? Well, the thing about chronic stress is it usually involves some kind of anxiety about the future, or it's the after effects of trauma in the body. Anxiety is based on projections and worries about the future, and trauma is a sense of being stuck in the past. When we're mindful, we're in the present moment. And we have the chance to step outside of ourselves and witness our experience. So in the guided meditation that we went through, we talked about just noticing your breath. And when you're pulled away by a thought, by an emotion, by a physical sensation, by a sound, we come back to the breath. Why do we come back to the breath? Because the breath anchors us in the moment. So we can step outside of ourselves, step outside of the story, and just experience directly what is arising and passing in our experience. It's kind of like witnessing a play that's on the stage with a cast of characters and costumes, scripts, props, sound effects, lights, the story that's unfolding in front of you. And we're on stage, but we're also in the audience, and we're also witnessing what's going on. We're feeling the emotions and observing the scene while knowing at a very deep level it's just a story. It's just a big story. It's a dream happening. Mindfulness meditation is not about changing our experience and wanting it to be different. Instead, it's becoming aware of what's going on, what's true moment to moment, breath to breath, thought and sound and sensation to thought and sound and sensation, and just watching and witnessing and standing back and observing and going, okay, isn't this interesting? I see what's going on. So, that's how it is. That's what's going on. I see how the same story comes up again and again. Okay. And remember in the guided meditation, I said the third part was witnessing with non-judgment and compassion and kindness. We just observe. It's non-judgmental attention to the details of all the experiences that arise and subside. We don't reject anything. We don't judge anything. We don't struggle to get away from it. We just watch it and experience it. The Buddha, in the Satipatthana Sutta, which was one of his most famous suttas, called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, this is a core teaching. If you really want to sink your teeth in to some of the Buddha's teachings, go study the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And simply put, the first foundation is mindfulness of body, bringing mindfulness to our body, directing our attention to the felt sensation of our experience. We notice what's going on in our body. See, we don't feel our feet. We think we feel our feet. We don't feel our feet. We feel pressure on our feet. We feel tingling. We feel itching. We feel warmth, we feel coolness. That's what we feel. It's the felt sense that we feel. It's mindfulness of the body. And mindfulness of breathing is part of that. Every breath we take that we're aware of, we're coming back to our body, bringing us back to the present moment. The second foundation is mindfulness of feeling, or feeling tones. In Sanskrit, it's called Vedana. And what it is, it refers to whether the sensations that we're experiencing are pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It's when our sense organs come in contact with external sense objects. What is our experience? Is that dog barking pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? It's how an object is experienced, the quality of the experience. Again, I'm just skimming over this really fast. The third is mindfulness of mind states, to the process and content of the mind. This is like the lens that color our world. It's sometimes referred to as a heart mind because it's a quality of consciousness. It's not just limited to our head. In the Buddhist teaching, there was no separation between head and heart. They weren't separate. They're one thing. There's one word to describe head and heart, citta. C-I-T-T-A. And the fourth is the mindfulness of phenomenon or objects of mind. And this guides the meditator through the whole curriculum of Buddhist psychology, the five hindrances, the five aggregates, the six sense spheres, the seven factors of awakening, and the four noble truths. And what we're doing here is we're investigating how phenomena actually function. Okay? So he gave us a roadmap. He gave us tools to practice mindfulness. And you can go into this like really, really deeply. And there are specific practices that you can do that are very basic. For example, a touch point meditation is one that Margaret and I use a lot, especially with people in early recovery. We're sometimes teaching meditation to men and women who were using not that long ago. So what we do is just help them get in their bodies and experience what it's like to be in their bodies. So I did this a little bit at the beginning of the meditation. Notice your feet on the floor, your butt against the chair or the cushion, your back perhaps against the chair, your hands in your lap, your lips touching, your eyelids touching, your clothing. When we experience anxiety or stress, that's something we can do is just go through our body. Get back in our body. And that gets us into the now. Just observe the felt sense, the sensations in our body. That's what we do in yoga, right? If we're doing yoga, we get in a posture and then we go, what's that like? What does this feel like? What's my experience being in our bodies? It's a way to find safety and tolerate strong sensations. Another practice that's really good is called mountain meditation. And this is one where we sit and we just kind of find stability in the midst of chaos. And we can experience what it's like to be a mountain. We've got them all around us. And we pass through the seasons, the summer, with the brightness and warmth, the fall and the changing color and the leaves dropping, and the winter with the storms and the snow and the ice, and the spring when the flowers come up. Do the mountains change? The mountain's still there. The mountain doesn't change. Through the course of a day, we can experience what it's like to be a mountain like that. There's a practice that you can do. Another one is simply listening. Being in an experience when we're in conversation with someone or in any relationship to any sound, just to anchor in the present moment awareness of listening and being present and listening. This is a mindfulness practice. Mindful eating. Mindful washing dishes. Mindful walking. Walking meditation is a basic, if you go on retreat, you know, someone says, well, how many hours a day do you meditate? Well, I meditate 6 hours or 8 hours. Well, some of that's walking meditation. And it's a very powerful experience just to notice what it's like just to be walking. Just to be walking. It really drops the awareness into the body, and it also gives us a break, you know. I mean, most people can't sit in a chair or on a cushion for hours on end. Unless you grew up in Asia or something, you know, and they're used to that. They don't have chairs. Well, maybe they do now. Another one that's really good is a body sweep, where we bring our awareness to our body and we just go through our body and just check all our different. You can do it rapidly, just kind of going head, you know, neck, shoulders, back, so on down to our feet and back up, or you can take a long time and go through. This is a very powerful practice for developing mindfulness. Other practices that are really, really important are compassion and loving kindness practices. There are times when just sitting and watching our breath or checking into our body is really, really difficult. Sometimes life is so hard. What we need to do is just bring our awareness to our present experience through self-compassion and being willing in a situation to just notice, I'm really suffering right now. This is really hard. We can say that to ourselves. We can stop in the midst of stress and just go, this is really hard. When you put your arms around yourself like this, it shifts your experience. And just say to yourself, may I feel balanced. May I feel safe. I'm not alone. This is common experience. So you can do metta practice, loving kindness practice for yourself. I do it sometimes when I find myself really in judgment of someone else or a situation, or I feel angry, because that hurts. That causes stress. I don't want to feel that way. So I'll just, may I be peaceful, may I be well, may I be at ease, and I just keep repeating these practices. Some of us, experience stress as a caregiver. Some of us are in a position, especially as we get older, where we may have parents, family members that need care. Margaret and I were at our accountant's office yesterday, and they live in a house, and they have a couple of extra rooms, and he was telling us that both of them have both parents, and they may get to a point where they need to take in their parents and care for them. Some of you may be in that experience. I know at least one person in this room who does hospice work. You know, and this can be really hard on us. You know, we care for people, we love them. Sometimes we worry about them. We may wake in the morning with a heavy heart or a mind full of what ifs, all the uncertainties. This really can take a toll on us. Watching loved ones wrestle with illness is heartbreaking. And it's really difficult just to stay present in the moment. There's a doctor, Hungarian-born, and he's a Canadian physician, but he actually grew up in Budapest. He was born during World War II. His name is Dr. Gábor Máté. And he's widely recognized for his real deep understanding of the connection of mind and body. He does a lot of work with addiction recovery and with trauma and stress. He says, now think about this if you are taking care of someone and your life is heavily invested in caregiving. He says, a compulsive and automatic concern for the needs of others while ignoring your own is a major risk factor for chronic illness. A compulsive and rigid identification with duty and role and responsibility rather than the needs of self is a major risk factor for chronic illness. Mindfulness practice is a way to bring your awareness into the present moment. Is notice what we're experiencing and work with it with kindness and compassion. And understand that it won't last for everything. It won't last forever. Everything arises and passes in our experience. She's on call. She's a doula.
Sorry.
She's allowed to do that. She may be going to the hospital very soon. That's what that call might mean. So, a lot of us live in kind of automatic pilot mode, or we travel through our days without really paying that much attention to what goes on. But when we're not paying attention, we're absent in our own life. Mindfulness is a potent antidote for stress, as well as just a powerful tool for knowing what we need as we non-judgmentally notice our thoughts, feelings, and body sensations. See how they all connect to how we respond to life. Remember I said, we don't react to what happens in our lives. We react to what we think about what happens in our lives. So by not being lost in these painful memories and projections about the future, there's so much more value in noticing what's happening right now and being able to respond skillfully in a way that best serves us and those around us.